Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We're happy to have you all here this afternoon. You are the first case on our docket for oral argument. We do have a second case on our docket for oral argument as well, but because we granted y'all's motion for additional time to argue, we've moved the second case for oral argument back a little bit. So if counsel are coming into the courtroom during your argument, don't be distracted. Just expect that, because they will be probably arriving at some point while you all are arguing. I understand counsel have announced their appearances, and all intend to take their full time, or at least reserve their full time. So with that, if you all are ready, I will have the clerk call the first case. Are you ready to proceed? May proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The issue before the court today, the record is complicated and extensive, of course, but the issue is actually quite simple. Do two private landowners in a service area of approximately 11,000 acres with thousands of residents and businesses that's growing, as everyone in this community knows, do two private landowners have the authority to secure a permanent and mandatory injunction forever barring a retail public utility from performing its public duties on a piece of property that it purchased, did not condemn, that it purchased in 2001 and has been operating for that purpose since 2001? The court should reverse and render a take-nothing judgment in this case, because the mandatory injunction violates three key pieces of law. First, binding Texas Supreme Court precedent, this court's own binding precedent, as well as Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution, which acknowledges that the Texas legislature can delegate these authorities and duties, including the right of eminent domain, to private corporations, and that right of eminent domain under the Texas Water Code can be exercised with or without a formal condemnation proceeding, unless to the extent we're actually taking their property. So, for example, here, no one is walking onto their land and asking them to convey property to build a water tower. The water tower here was purchased. The only question is whether the restrictive covenants can be enforced injunctively, not in terms of damages, which they have not claimed here, nor have they presented any evidence of, but affirmatively restrain a retail public utility from forever using that property for the purposes that the legislature has empowered them.
What about the argument that they have raised their eminent domain claim in as a defense?
The adverse condemnation claim as a defense? We actually think that was abandoned, but even if they have raised it, that is their only remedy. Here they aren't seeking damages. They presented no evidence of damages. They did not ask for a jury finding regarding damages. They only want injunctive relief. They want to force the corporation to tear down the water tower and to perhaps build a shorter one or build it somewhere else. That injunctive relief is barred by two cases that are binding on this court. The Texas Supreme Court's decision in City of Galveston versus Wynn. And that case, the predominant decision was decided by the Galveston Court of Appeals, but it was affirmed per curiam. It was actually writ refused per curiam by the Texas Supreme Court. It is an old case, but it is absolutely still good law. And the reason it's good law is it says this: while we may have taken the Stargate site subject to certain restrictive covenants, when all of these landowners took their own properties, according to the Texas Supreme Court's analysis in Wynn, and this case, this court's analysis in City of River Oaks, they take it subject to the government's power of eminent domain. Of course they do. Because the concept that private landowners can say, well, we have agreed amongst ourselves that no one can ever do X unless we permit them, that would contravene the state's constitutional authority to condemn for public purpose. And in fact, it is undisputed here. The parties agree, and in fact, I'll quote from, I believe, their brief. Quote, a restrictive covenant cannot take away the power of eminent domain. Restrictions that, quote, impair that right are void against public policy. That is their brief at page 38. That is absolutely correct. That is consistent with the Texas Supreme Court's holding in Wynn, as well as this court's decision in City of River Oaks. Now, City of River Oaks is directly on point. It involved a case with the construction of two water towers, and it offended local residents. They didn't like the water towers. So they asked the trial court to enter an injunction tearing the water towers down. Now, the trial court did not, in River Oaks, actually enter an injunction, but what the trial court did is submitted a series of questions about whether there had been, whether the restrictive covenants applied and whether they could be enforced. And this court held, and this was a writ referred NRE case, this court held that it was error to even submit those questions to the jury in the first instance because restrictive covenants that are enforced to restrain, this is not about damages, but to restrain this government function are void as against public policy. That is absolutely still good law. The only manner in which they've attempted to distinguish that law is saying since then, courts have talked about and confirmed that restrictive covenants are property rights. We agree, they run with the land. We have no problem with that. But even though those property rights run with the land and individual owners may have an interest in them, that in no way abrogates the state's authority to effectuate its public purpose or the entities to which the state delegates that authority. In fact, that authority is expressed in Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution, which specifically envisions in Section A, subsection A, that the state can delegate eminent domain authority to certain corporations. Now, there are two ways that that eminent domain authority can be exercised. First is a formal condemnation proceeding. That's what happened, for example, if one is going to build a wall along the border of Texas, there are going to be a lot of private landowners who own that property. And there may have to be formal condemnations before that physical property can be taken and payment must be made in advance. The same is not the case if there is an allegation that the restrictive covenants may have been violated. If anything, there may be a claim for damages, but they cannot restrain the conduct on, and mind you, this is not a lot that is directly adjacent to this, to Saddleburg subdivision. It's thousands of feet away, in some cases half a mile away. So these are two private landowners who are saying, we have these restrictive covenants and we now have a permanent injunction that on its face actually prevents this water corporation from complying with any of its statutory duties and
but yes, is there ma'am. A distinction to be drawn by the fact that the water company purchased the land and it actually contains the as part of the deed restrictions and enforcement of the restrictive covenant?
It doesn't matter, Your Honor. And in fact, those issues were addressed in the Wynn case as well as I believe it is the McCarthy case. The fact that it was actually it was purchased instead of conveyed by condemnation is that they didn't have to go through the condemnation proceedings with respect to the property itself. The only question is, are there negative, so for example, I believe it was, it's either Wynn or McCarthy. I think it's McCarthy, actually, that distinguishes between a taking and damages. So when there is a negative interest here, a contract that says nobody in this area where the restrictions are subject to can do certain things, that may be enforceable in terms of damages. But as to an entity that has eminent domain authority, it cannot be applied to restrict them from doing something. The only question is whether or not they can state a claim for damages. Here, they've abandoned that claim. No, the answer is no, it does not make a difference. And again, these issues were addressed in Wynn, and they were addressed in City of River Oaks. And in fact, I'll quote from Wynn, restrictions, quote, that are binding as between private parties, quote, do not in any manner affect the city's right to take such lot as it is needed for a public fire station by virtue of condemnation statutes. And in fact, and this analysis applies perfectly well here, I mean, thinking about this, the consequences of this case. Quote, if each resident may enjoin construction and maintenance of a fire station near to or on lots adjacent to his residence, then indeed the city would be powerless to erect a fire station in any part of the city. That's why in 1940, the Texas Supreme Court in the Higginbotham case said that when an entity to which the Texas legislature has conferred eminent domain authority, and it's undisputed here that we have that authority, once it is determined that a particular thing in a particular place is necessary to effectuate that statutory purpose, unless there is a showing that that decision was arbitrary or capricious, was made fraudulently, or was in some other respect facially illegal, that is left to the sound discretion of the entity. In fact, Higginbotham said that it is not even judicially cognizable. It should not and cannot be submitted to a jury. And the way the Higginbotham court addressed it is, it said, this is the problem with it, and this is the problem here, that if different courts and juries were allowed to pass on the question of necessity, this water tower at this site, then you're going to get conflicting results based from neighborhood to neighborhood, from jury to jury. And that would make it impossible for the state, the way it has authorized in Chapter 13 and Chapter 67 of the Texas Water Code, we'd never be able to keep up with development. I mean, think about this community. Since 2001, when we bought the Stargate site, and the water facilities plan that our engineer put together and that Cross Timbers relied upon in coming up with this water tower, plans through 2040. Infrastructure takes a long time to implement. There are new subdivisions, there are new businesses, there are new developments, and they require not only water for domestic use, but water for fire hydrants. And in 2015, our engineer, Maroney, who testified at the hearings, whose testimony was presented during summary judgment proceedings, he had already recommended to Cross Timbers to take action to reduce flow in order to make sure there was adequate reserves for fire. That was in 2015. And he said those restrictions should stay in place until the water tower is completed. And mind you, at this site, the water tower is 85 to 90% completed. What this injunction compels is to tear the water tower down and to forever, never be able to use the Stargate for the retail public utilities, which is how we're classified statutorily, to never be able to use it in a way that the landowners don't like under the restrictive covenants. That is not the way Texas law works. It's simply not. Now, we have never claimed, nor do we now, that they are without remedy. And in fact, that is the reason why the mandatory injunction was a clear abuse of discretion. Now, the cases, they talk about this difference between irreparable harm. They say they don't have to show there was any harm or an adequate remedy because there was indication that we were going to violate the covenants. We don't concede that it's a violation of covenants, but assuming for this purposes right now, assuming that it would have conflicted with the restrictive covenants, they still have to show there's no adequate remedy at law. Now, it's one thing as between private landowners. Somebody wants to build a Tuscan villa in an adobe neighborhood, right? That an injunction between private landowners to enforce deed restrictions is perfectly consistent with that private contract right. But what Wynn and this court's analysis in City of River Oaks stand for is that when it comes to an entity with eminent domain authority, and it doesn't have to be an entity with sovereign immunity, but an entity that has been conferred with that governmental purpose, if they have a claim for damages, that's Wynn, that's City of River Oaks. And in fact, in Wynn, the injunction was absolutely improper. And they said, look, if anything, you have a claim for damages. You're not without remedy, but you cannot enjoin this conduct. And that's exactly the...
I hear your discussion, and I understand your position, that there is not a issue in this case at this time concerning inverse condemnation.
There seems to be a dispute about that now, Your Honor. They non-suited their claim against us. In their responsive brief, they indicated that their adverse condemnation claim is still live. Irrespective, the court should reverse and render to the extent they have any compensable claim. There's actually a second condemnation proceeding was instituted on April 5th. We will update the court with
everything in this case is complicated, including your response to my question. What I meant asking you is, if this court were to reverse and remand, is it your client's position that the claim for inverse condemnation would not be a part of a remand?
Your Honor, we believe that the inverse condemnation claim is abandoned. There's nothing in the record to support damages, but if the court were of the view that the record supported a claim, then yes, it should be addressed on remand.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Robert Hager, Nichols, Jackson, Dillard, Hager, and Smith for the town of Bartonville. As your honors have reviewed the record in this case, this has been a longstanding and, for me, an enlightening journey since 2005 when this issue first came to the city, or in this case, town council. And this is kind of odd that I'm kind of arguing against myself at this point. But the issue that's presented to the court regarding the town of Bartonville is a claim by the appellee or the plaintiffs in this case, if you will, the Armies et al., is that the town engaged in a contract zoning and therefore violated the Texas Enabling Act and abdicated its responsibility as a town council to make a land use decision. We do not believe that's the case. We believe that the trial court was absolutely correct in ruling as a matter of law that this was not contract zoning. To recount some of the factual history in this case, back in 2005, a plat was originally filed in for the property in issue, which identified this Stargate site as having two ground storage tanks, approximately 30 feet high. Subsequent to that time, and that plat was approved, some of the plaintiffs that are in the courtroom today were present when that occurred. Subsequent to that, the Water Supply Corporation thought it was in its best interest to put an elevated water tower, and they were told that they would have to get a conditional use permit under the city's zoning ordinance. As the court's aware, a conditional use permit is a use that's recognized within the zoning district subject to certain conditions or special conditions which may be imposed on that use in order to make it compatible with surrounding property uses. On two occasions, those applications for that conditional use permit were denied by the town council. As a result, a lawsuit was filed where the town was sued by what is now Cross Timbers Water Supply Corporation, claiming that we had violated principles of sound zoning. And that case was pending when the town finally, through probably some change in some of the political perspectives in the town, was approached by the Water Supply Corporation, and the town approached the Water Supply Corporation, and they got together and decided it would be in everyone's best interest to resolve their differences for the lawsuit. As part of that, they requested that we grant them the zoning in that contract. They were told we could not do that. We entered into a settlement agreement. That settlement agreement was conditioned, and I think that Exhibit 3 in the Army's brief has a copy of the contract, and I ask the court to pay attention to paragraphs 4 and 5, where it says that nothing contained in this agreement shall obligate the planning and zoning or the town council to grant the CUP, and like language with regard to the building permit, which would have to be obtained in order for to build a water tower.
But wasn't it a condition of the settlement agreement?
It was a condition of the settlement agreement. If the zoning, it was a condition precedent to the agreement. And that, in, if the court would look at the, we cited the case of Dacey versus Village of Rio Doso. And in that case, they said that that condition was not a condition of zoning, it was a condition of the agreement would be effective. So if the agreement, if the zoning was never granted, the agreement would never come to fruition, the lawsuit against the city would be in place. And so for that reason, I think what contract zoning really is, and I think the Dacey versus Village of Rio Doso case where there's a dearth of cases in Texas on this issue, but the Rio Doso case is almost on all fours with here, and I find it very instructive, having been a municipal lawyer for 40 years. And it goes through the process and says, what is contract zoning? And contract zoning is where the city promises to grant a use to a property owner in exchange for consideration. In this case, that's not what happened. We did not have, and the court in that case was very careful to examine and review the discretion that the legislative body has. They cite the Zoning Enabling Act in New Mexico, which is almost on all fours with our Zoning Enabling Act here in Texas, that there are procedures in place, there's planning and zoning hearings have to take place, notice has to take place, there's a vote of the Planning and Zoning Commission to make that recommendation, and subsequent hearing before the City Council, and a subsequent vote of the Town Council in our case. And there was no contracting away those procedural safeguards. So the granting of the zoning was not contractually predestined. And
Chair Mayor.
Yes, sir.
Are you familiar with the letter of April 21st, 2014?
Yes, sir, I am.
Who wrote it?
I did.
When you use words like, we are writing to provide a proposed counteroffer to your letter, doesn't that sound like negotiations to reach an agreement?
There was negotiations, and I don't think that there was ever an attempt to hide those negotiations, but never, ever was there ever a negotiation of whether or not the town would grant the zoning.
They were only going to grant it if all of the conditions were met.
Conditions as to the zoning requirements, yes.
What you call them are conditions precedent in paragraph 4 that you just talked about.
Yes, and that's conditions precedent not to the zoning but to the agreement.
I understand. It's a condition precedent to what we might do if we make an agreement that we're going to work out with you the zoning and the lawsuits, and you're going to pay us $350,000.
For them having sued us on at least two occasions.
Did I get those steps right?
The steps were this.
I'm reading them now. I don't mean to dispute, stop you, but I'm saying I understand what you contend in your brief and in this letter would be the things that would have to happen for there to be an agreement.
For the agreement to take effect, yes. Not
right.
For the zoning to be granted. Therein lies the difference. The zoning
see, I'm
is
having
not
trouble. I'm really having trouble divorcing what you contend to be language in this letter that revoked that is really the settlement agreement. In the letter, the settlement agreement?
Yes.
And then the city says, okay, if we get these conditions met, all of which are conditions that are discretionary under the control of the city, then what we'll do is make this deal and you'll pay us $350,000.
I don't read it that way, and it was not intended that way, and it wasn't invoked in that way. What happened was this, there was a lawsuit. They had sued us. This was to get rid of the lawsuit.
That had already been handled by the appellate court. And,
yes, and it was reversed and sent back.
Yes.
That's when the tower was half built, and it has not any work occurred on
well,
it
let
since
me ask
then.
You, let me ask it to you this way, just to clarify my mind from all the things I've read. This has been a very well briefed and very well written briefs in this case, sir, including yours. Thank you. Did the city get the $350,000?
I believe they've been paid some of the actual attorney's fees that were incurred as a result of I can't answer that question because I'm no longer the town attorney, so I don't know if
all that money has been funded. You don't know if they paid it all yet or not?
No, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for answering my question, sir.
So I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
In summation, we believe that the Ruidoso case sets forth the requirements, if you will, or the doctrine of contract zoning. Those elements do not exist in this case. We believe the Darcy case or the Dacey case has been cited throughout the United States as authority for what contract zoning is. In this case, the record clearly shows that all of the hearings were held in accordance with the law. They were contested by both the applicant and the opponents of the water tower. Hearings were held. There was votes taken. They were not always unanimous. There was a split of vote in, on the granting of the CUP. There was a splitting of the vote of entering into the agreement. That these were done in the public view. There was no contract, if you will, to predestine what the zoning would be in this case. And for those reasons, the elements of contract zoning are not applicable or are not found in this case. The court was correct in making its determination that as a matter of, my time's up, but as a matter of law that there is not contract zoning. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hager.
May it please the court, very pleased to be up here for my first argument before the court. Justice Meyer, to your question, in their briefing, the town cites Hall versus City of Durham about whether or not there should be a meeting of minds. I think the back and forth negotiations with that absolutely are evidence of a meeting of the minds. In our briefing, we also point the court to the distinction between conditions precedent to formation of an agreement and conditions precedent to liability or performance. There are clauses within that agreement that show that there are enforceable at that time without those other conditions going forth. Ruidoso case is certainly instructive, but it's not the whole matter. We point the court to Heidrick versus Village of Niles out of Illinois, Chung versus Sarasota out of Florida, which is a case directly about a settlement of a lawsuit that was, in that case, conditioned as contract zoning. And we also talk about Hale versus Osborne Coal out of Alabama, again, a settlement of a lawsuit. Kind of what those cases discuss are that when you have these sorts of agreements, you do have to divorce yourself from a normal zoning process. It's not just whether they went through the procedures, but whether they went through the procedures in an above-board fashion. We don't believe that that can ever exist with the agreement we have in place. A lot of the cases that they have cited and that are about contract zoning that go against us are cases where there's someone standing up at a town meeting or something unilaterally saying, hey, town council, if you grant us this, we'll do X. I think the Massachusetts case Durand talks about, they had a press release, we're going to donate $8 million to the school district, I think. That was sort of unilateral. Here we do have a bilateral contract. And we do point the court to evidence at volume 17 of the reporter's record, page 43. The mayor admitted that everyone on the council knew that the only way to benefit under the settlement agreement was to first pass those zoning that they had requested. The way that this went down is pure contract zoning. The question before the court is, can a town enact a zoning the way they did here? And we don't believe they can.
Well, how do you think that Cross Timbers and the city could have resolved that lawsuit?
My preference would have been for the town to push forward and go ahead and require what the San Antonio Court of Appeals told them to do and demolish the water tower. We may have a different procedural posture had that happened. I don't know exactly how the best way to settle that lawsuit would be, but we point the court to where all of these conditions have nothing to do with the actual zoning passed. They're all about infrastructure improvements to other parts of the town. They're all about money to pay back for lawsuits. They're about indemnity for this appeal. that we had put them on notice of. So they knew about this. They had planned a draft around it, and it just doesn't pass muster, in our opinion. At the beginning, Ms. Hanks said that this case is simple, and I agree. Are we going to hold these bad actors accountable? To us, this case is ultimately about holding people to their word. We do not believe that Wynn versus City of River, or Wynn and City of River Oaks versus Moore, are any more good law. We point the court to Harris County Flood Control District versus Glenbrook Patio, where the Houston court said, we conclude that neither Wynn, Moore, nor Farmer, which is another Fort Worth case from the mid-50s, I believe, are helpful to this case because at the time these cases were decided, real covenants had not been recognized in Texas as a property interest. Glenbrook also goes on to talk about McCarthy. Restrictive covenants interest in real estate must be compensated if damaged or extinguished in a condemnation proceeding. And that brings us to our other point. There is no, the record before this court is that there is no condemnation. They filed one at the time. We've supplied the court with the judgment dismissing that case. So there's no condemnation before this court in this court's record. As far as inverse condemnation goes, we point the court to El Dorado versus City of McKinney, Texas Southern University versus Cape Conroe. Both of those cases talk about when is it available to extinguish an intangible real property right through an inverse condemnation. And they talk about one of the key differences is trying to enforce that right and then the state saying, no, we have sovereign immunity, and just because we signed on to a contract, we're not, that doesn't mean we waive our immunity. And it is that point that taking occurs for those entities. And even in Glenbrook, there was not an inverse claim. There was a counterclaim by the flood control district to actually take the property rights. But the Glenbrook court talked about something. District did not compensate. This is at page 577, 578. District did not compensate upon purchasing and refused to pay the assessment fees. So the homeowners association there tried to get them to pay. They said no, and they can hide behind that sovereign immunity. We don't have that here. We can enforce their contractual rights under this very lawsuit. We have the ability under the CCRs to say, you signed up for them. Justice Walker, as you pointed out, it's in their deed. They knew what they were signing up for. And under that contractual right, we have the ability to say, no, you signed up for it. You can't use your house or your land in that way.
Well, so are you taking the position that eminent domain powers always have to yield to restrictive covenants?
I am taking the position here that if there is an eminent domain, it must be an affirmative assertion of eminent domain. There cannot be an inverse condemnation by a private entity of an intangible real property right. That analysis may change if there's actual physical dirt involved, but as far as these intangible rights, El Dorado involved a reversionary interest, Texas Southern versus Cape Conroe talked about assessment fees, and the condo association or the homeowners association there, you know, again tried to assert their right. Those are real property rights, but they're contractual in nature, and so they're asserted through a lawsuit. When someone won't comply. Here, because they are a private entity, they are only given what the state allows them to have, what the legislature has delegated to them. And yes, the legislature has delegated the right of eminent domain, but that means they must assert it in compliance with the Texas Property Code and any other applicable law. Here, because we have the ability through a lawsuit to enforce these covenants, they don't have the ability to inversely condemn. It's simply not there.
But the problem with that position that I'm having is that basically then the water company would have been better off to use eminent domain or condemnation powers to obtain the land than to purchase it.
I understand that, Your Honor. And in some situations, when a state entity purchases the land, they might be able to extinguish. Glenbrook does talk about that. Again, though, because we have the ability to enforce, it's a little bit different analysis. And there's no procedural barrier for a lawsuit. There's no immunity from suit or liability in that situation.
The other thing I don't understand about your necessity argument is that why would a not-for-profit entity be wanting to build something more expensive if it wasn't necessary?
That's a great question for their shareholders or their members. Your Honor, I think the record before the court is, at least from our expert's viewpoint, they've never been able to actually justify this. We point the court to several instances in the record where it's proven that they just sort of made this up as they went along and justified it after the fact. And so I disagree that it's actually necessary and that there's actually been an expert, a credible expert opinion on that.
Is that even a requirement?
No, Your Honor. This court said in Guajardo versus Nice, talking about, talk about a dog breeder, but public policy of the state of Texas is to enforce reasonably drawn restrictive covenants. And that's what we have here. We have a private entity that hasn't taken these things, and until they do so, it's the policy of the state to enforce these covenants. And it's the policy of the state to hold them to their contractual word.
Counsel, I'm listening to what you're saying to Justice Walker. Your idea is that, okay, you may have these powers of eminent domain, and if what you do is keep your gun in your holster and you don't ever fire, you never use it, then the fact that you acquired this property knowing that these restrictive covenants were in place, and they were in place when you bought the property from the people, then you don't get to come in here now and talk about powers of eminent domain that you've not used.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. They didn't use them. They bought it. They knew what they were going to do all along, and the problem is that they represented. I think the record shows that the manager at the time, Mr. Legere, said, no, we're only going to put these 36-foot-tall tanks there. Well, the record shows that, no, his idea all along is we are going to put a water tower. We're just not going to tell anybody.
I'm a little confused about the expert testimony, because apparently there was a lot of talk about expert testimony that wasn't testified. In other words, there's some people, this Moroni person you're talking about in your briefing, that didn't ever really testify in court.
He testified pre-trial, but that's never been in front of the jury, and that's not a jury issue.
I concede to you that wasn't an issue submitted to the jury in the records we have. But it's talked about as being demonstrative of whether there was an actual deed in order for the utility to meet its public duty of having an available water supply for the city as well as the fire department. You follow my?
I'm not, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
All right. What I'm trying to get around to is whether the concept of public need, which the utility district is asserting, was there. You have to have this. I guess we don't know how tall exactly the letter agreement said, 160 feet.
It'll be, I believe, 155, 156 feet
All right,
at completion.
So we have to have this tall water tower in order for us to meet our needs, that meet the public needs that we are attempting to serve according to our charter. Right?
Yes, sir.
Now, I didn't understand that there was testimony developed about that went to the jury.
There's no testimony about that went to the jury, Your Honor. That was some of that was developed in preliminary injunction hearings before the jury trial. Some of that was developed in these other lawsuits that have gone on.
Or in city council meetings?
Or in city council meetings, yes, Your Honor.
So aren't we talking a little bit more hypothetical here than actual in terms of eminent domain and inverse condemnation and matters of that kind?
Absolutely. It is very hypothetical, and I think that goes back to my point, is here the issue is, are we going to enforce reasonably drawn restrictive covenants that a private entity contracted for? It's extend their deed. They knew about it. They had we developed testimony at trial that they had an opportunity to review and have them removed if they wanted to. And they just simply didn't do that. And so they take these affirmative actions to have these covenants, and then they want to have every opportunity to avoid them. And that's what we're asking this court to do, is to uphold these covenants and to uphold those contractual obligations. Paragraph 3.4 of the CCRs talks about enforcement, and it presumes and states that we are entitled to enforce these by injunction, for damages, or both. And that, by having these covenants on their land, that's their contractual obligation too. And they know, they've been on notice of this since they bought the land, that they're subject to injunction if they do something that someone feels violates the covenants. Ms. Hanks said that they don't necessarily concede they violated the CCRs. I point the court to the jury verdict that said that they did. And that's the record before this court. A jury looked at this and found that there is a violation.
Is there any significance to the fact that the jury found that there was not a lot involved?
No, Your Honor. If you look at 8.3 and 8.4, that talks, when you look at those paragraphs, that talks about the following is prohibited within the community. Both of them, both 8.3 and 8.4 say that. And when you go down, and then it lists all the things we sit under. The testimony, uncontested at trial, is that the Stargate site where the water tower sits is within the community. And so all of the lots and owners and things, it's of no moment. I can't remember if we attached it to our main briefing or to any reply brief, but there is a map that our surveying expert put together. It's colored, and it shows the removal of the covenants from that phase two, but the Stargate site is still on it. That's still within the community as defined by the original covenants. And so because it's within the community, whether there's a lot or an owner or anything else, it's sort of a red herring, because 8.3 and 8.4 simply say these are prohibited within the community, and here's what the community is.
Do you agree that the CCRs prohibit the 36 feet tall low water tanks, paragraph 8.3Q and 8.4B?
Yes, Your Honor. That is our position, that they do, that those tanks would also violate the covenants. We're simply not seeking to enforce it for those. Those are not something that we find would impact our quiet use and enjoyment in conjunction with the CCRs. I believe we point the court to Stewart v. Welsh that talks about we're entitled to enforce a covenant, and there's no waiver for different violations in different magnitudes. And that's sort of what we have here. I think in my briefing we did the Walmart versus a mom and pop shop, and that's what we have here. We had a small, unobtrusive use that everyone knew about going in and no one had a problem with. And then they build a much larger, of such greater magnitude, use, and that's when the enforcement comes in. So, yes, Your Honor, that those would violate the covenants, but it's just not something that we would seek to enforce. Ms. Hanks also said that they can't ever use their property for continuous and adequate service. We disagree. The injunction is drafted to comply with those original ground use tanks. The judgment references Jury Exhibit 47, which is their original statement of intent for those ground storage tanks, and I think there were some other facilities next to that. We don't have a problem with it. We're not trying to stop them from serving their community and from providing continuous and adequate service. This water tower is of a greater magnitude. We're allowed to enforce that under longstanding Supreme Court precedent in that manner. Ms. Hank said that the water tower is about 90% up, and that's true. It is. but it's only 90% up because they put it up in the first place. They took a risky maneuver to begin with. Page 2351 of the clerk's record is some testimony from one of the prior lawsuits where CTWSC's lawyer, Mr. Burke, when they're putting up a bond to bond around the town's right to suspend judgment, says it's their risk to take. We know what we're getting into. Well, that's what we're asking this court to uphold. They knew what they were getting into. Their plan since day one was to simply get it up and see if anyone's actually going to make them tear it down. The trial court finally said so, and they found every opportunity to avoid the responsibility that they've already admitted that they have. So we ask this court to hold them accountable, to hold the town accountable for contract zoning, ask this court to affirm on the restrictive covenants issue, ask this court to reverse on the contract zoning issue. Thank you for your time.
Counsel, before you sit down.
Yes, sir.
I'm reading the special warranty deed from Saddlebrook Estates LP to Bartonville. In the negotiations on that purchase, was there disclosure of the planned usage of the property being purchased?
Yes, Your Honor. We developed testimony from Sue Shelton, who represented the developer Saddlebrook Estates. And I believe the record reflects, I would have to go back and look at it, but I believe the record reflects that she knew what they were doing and had no problem with
it. That limited partnership, was that, how was that related to the estates, Saddlebrook Estates?
My time's up, Mab.
I need you to answer that anyway. Judges, may he answer the question.
Okay. That was the original developer. It may have been the limited partner of the general partner of the developer, however that structure worked out. And then once so many homes were sold out there, the HOA control reverted from
and
the...
And I understand that, looking at the restrictions. My only concern was whether or not there was any kind of evidence in this mound of evidence we have to look at, that there was a discussion on the initial purchase of the fact that the property was saddled with the restrictive covenants.
There is a seller's disclosure or some document to that effect, I can supplement that, that gives the water supply company the opportunity to review zoning and some other thing and any use restrictions. So they had full awareness of it.
Before the purchase.
Yes, Your Honor, before the purchase.
Thank you, Counsel.
Ms. Hanks, rebuttal. And if you will add 1 minute to Ms. Hanks' rebuttal time, since we went over.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, I'd like to address your question. I believe what Your Honor is getting at is the question of what did we take Stargate subject? Did we know about the restrictive covenants? Do I understand the judge?
Reading of the record is that you did know about them.
Well, Your Honor, the answer to the question is, regardless of what the record says, it doesn't matter. And the reason for that is when they bought their property, it is subject to the right of eminent domain, to the exercise of for the purpose of public use. And in fact, I'll direct the court's attention to City of Houston versus Wynn, which, again, is still good Texas Supreme Court law. And I quote, while the plaintiffs purchased their lots subject to deed restrictions, those restrictions in no matter militated against the power or authority of the city to take property for public use, although such taking might damage lots purchased by them for residential purposes.
Ms. Hanks, you're again talking about powers that are on the books and that was available to utility but were not used.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the first
part. Were not used.
You mean the right of eminent domain?
That's right. They did not. You said that we got these powers in our pocket and we can use them. And they do say that deed restrictions are no good against the power of eminent domain granted by the legislature to this particular entity.
There's
but we just didn't use them, and therefore we're just going to talk about them now and cite them as authority for the proposition that the deed restriction should not be applied?
Well, the answer to your question, well, in response to your question, Your Honor, first, we have used them. We are not required to institute a formal condemnation proceeding in order to exercise. That's consistent with Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution, which distinguishes between a taking of property versus damages that may be effectuated on the property. And in fact, that's consistent with the Glenbrook Patio Homes case that they rely on. Glenbrook Patio Homes said, in that case, the plaintiffs wanted damages. They wanted assessments up until the day that the plaintiff or the defendant, the entity, formally brought a counterclaim. And the court said, no. They didn't have to formally bring a condemnation proceeding. The damages are limited to when they actually engaged in conduct that interfered with those rights. So if they allege that the water tower, when we started building it, I don't know if it's at 20 feet or 40 feet or 80 feet, whatever point it got to the point where it offended them and they wanted to enforce the restrictive covenants, which wasn't until June of 2014. If that's the point, when they felt like their rights were extinguished, that's when condemnation happened. That's when it happened. And their remedy is, under Wynn, under Higginbotham, under City of River Oaks, under Glenbrook Patio Homes, their remedy is damages. Now, the second response to your question, Your Honor, is they say they haven't been entirely candid with the court because they're aware that on April, the initial condemnation action, which we brought just entirely out of an abundance of caution to try to get this resolved, the initial was dismissed. On April 5th, 2017, County Court at Law, number 2, Civil Action 2017-00840, we have now instituted a formal condemnation proceeding against every single owner in Saddlebrook Estates. Now, we don't think that's necessary. We think this court should confirm that the two disgruntled landowners, the only two who are seeking damage, who are seeking remedy, they're limited to damages. We don't think this kind of action is required every time a retail public utility tries to perform its public function. If not, imagine the consequences. Every single time there may or may not be a complaint about a restrictive covenant, we're going to end up in formal condemnation proceeding with thousands of landowners. Now, the other thing that I will say is counsel suggested that the San Antonio Court of Appeals required demolition of the tower. That is not correct. The San Antonio Court of Appeals reversed because the district court exceeded its jurisdiction. It did not order the demolition of the water towers. And finally, they say that they believe the 36-foot tall storage tank violates the restrictive covenants. Well, if that's the case, then even that is prohibited. They cannot, that's not what the injunction says. The injunction says we are forever barred from doing anything that is inconsistent with the restrictive covenants. And apparently, in their view, it just depends on how they feel about it. 36 feet is okay, higher than that isn't. What happens next time? If we paint it blue, is that going to offend their sense of aesthetics? What they're doing is not holding us accountable. They're holding this entity that is charged by the legislature to provide this service, they're holding Cross Timbers hostage. That's what's happening here. And for that reason, the court should reverse the injunction. Unless the court has any other questions, I yield my time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Hanks, thank you for your argument. Mr. Hager, Mr. Witten, thank you very much for your argument and for your briefing here today. As Justice Meyer said, your briefs are very helpful to the court, as have been your arguments. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.